From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, and this morning we speak first with Alex DeVries, author of a paper in the scientific publication Joule. It's titled The Growing Energy Footprint of Artificial Intelligence, and he'll talk about the true energy consumption of these large language models. Then we speak with Greg Epstein, who is the humanist chaplain at Harvard and MIT. We'll talk about the worship of technology and his new book, Tech Agnostic, how technology became the world's most powerful religion and why it desperately needs a reformation. Stay with us. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. We'll be back after these words.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
As AI and ChatGPT continue to grow, and as people increase their usage of these large language models, so do the energy and resource requirements. A report last year in the journal Joule showed that ChatGPT consumes up to 17,000 times more electricity than the average U.S. household, and that AI is on track to use more electricity than most small nations, including Ireland. Even Elon Musk admits that there might not be enough power by 2025 to feed AI's insatiable appetite for electricity. Here to tell us more about AI's use of electricity and other resources is Alex DeVries, author of the paper, The Growing Energy Footprint of Artificial Intelligence. He is also the founder of Digiconomist, a research company dedicated to exposing the unintended consequences of digital trends. Alex, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So Alex, tell us how AI is generated. It sounds like it's different from the typical computer data that we're used to using.
Yeah, the thing with AI is that it's an umbrella term. So it actually captures quite a lot from really basic machine learning models all the way to the generative AI that we have come to know over the past 2 years. And the thing is, there's lots of different techniques. They also tend to have a common process. So at least one commonality is that in all these cases, you first have to train a model that you can then use to do something in a live environment, which we did call the inference phase, or well, simply the operational phase. During your training phase, and depending on what kind of application you're trying to build, it can be something like ChatGPT, but it can also be something completely different. You're basically starting out with an arbitrary amount of data and an arbitrary model with an arbitrary amount of parameters. Like, these are all choices that you can make. We tend to choose to put in as much data as possible because whatever comes out tends to perform better the more we put in. And then we end up with multi-billion parameter models like ChatGPT, which can then serve as, well, pieces of text, basically.
So what started you down this path exploring the energy use of large language models?
Well, the thing is that I've been researching the energy consumption of something else for the past 8 years. I've been looking at the energy consumption of cryptocurrency mining, specifically Bitcoin mining, which was actually responsible for quite an impressive growth between the years 2018 and 2023. It kind of came out of nowhere and suddenly became responsible for 0.5% of global electricity consumption. And actually, within the context of data centers, that is about as much power as data centers were using altogether before cryptocurrency mining showed up. So that came out of nowhere, and I really thought that that deserved to get some attention. So I started researching things like, okay, what's the energy consumption impact of all of this? What's the carbon emission impact of all of this? The water consumption, the electronic waste. And then I thought I was kind of done with all of it. And then suddenly ChatGPT popped up, and I kind of figured, like, hey, hold up. This is a very energy intensive technology, actually very much due to this bigger is better dynamic that tends to be embedded in AI. Hey, you make these models bigger, they perform better, which is great. But the downside is it means you need to use more and more resources and thus energy to make it all run. And I thought, like, okay, if this gets adopted at a massive scale, which actually started to happen with ChatGPT, then this energy consumption can really rise rapidly. And actually, my research last year was very much focused on trying to get a grasp of, okay, what is going to be the direction of this growth for the coming few years? And then I actually found like, hey, hold up, this can actually have a very similar growth trajectory as cryptocurrency mining before. And I really thought that, okay, this is something that people really have to be aware about, of course, because this is just a rapid grower.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Alex DeVries, who's joining us to talk about the consumptive nature of AI, which it's funny when you sort of read the title of your paper, Alex, it's probably something that most of us haven't thought about before or realized the amount of data translates into energy use. And many of us, however, have heard about what you've been studying is the energy consumption of cryptocurrency mining. And so I'm wondering about that. How have we dealt with the increased energy consumption? I mean, when cryptocurrency came onto the scene, there was a lot going on with it. People were mining, you know, crypto at home and would have these huge energy banks in the garage. And how has that turned out? How have we dealt with that? And does that give us any inroads into how we're going to deal with the consumption of AI?
Well, unfortunately, the very short answer would be we haven't really dealt with it. Cryptocurrency mining is still very much having a big impact today. Is the only thing that has changed is that we just don't read as much about it anymore because the headlines nowadays tend to be focused on AI rather than cryptocurrency. So everyone moved on to the next hype. But actually, cryptocurrency mining today has an even bigger impact than it was having before, especially with Bitcoin recently hitting record highs. Maybe no one's getting those headlines anymore, but definitely in the background, this system is still consuming a lot of power, even more power than ever before. And we never really did anything about it. Like in Europe, they did introduce something to at least get some insights into this. So in Europe, they introduced a new legislation called the Marketing Crypto Assets Regulation, and that forces the crypto asset service providers in Europe to start providing data on environmental indicators for, well, cryptocurrency products that they're offering to investors. So they have to disclose stuff like energy consumption, carbon footprint, and this will all start as of next year, 2025. But that's like the most concrete thing that has happened, and it's not really a whole lot. It's just aimed at generating some more insights, but it doesn't mean that anything will really change beyond that. If people don't care about these numbers, nothing will still change. And in the US, I know that this type of legislation has at a certain point been discussed, but it never really passed. And that's in the US, that's actually very interesting because, well, Europe is definitely not a hotspot for cryptocurrency mining. It's all in the US, actually. The majority of the Bitcoin mining activity globally, or at least a very significant chunk of it, is taking place right in the US. I know that there have been some efforts to try to get information from this industry as it's having quite an impact on local grids, especially in states like Texas, where cryptocurrency mining is usually popular, but, at least the state officials are definitely souring on their attitude towards this industry because the benefits are not very clear. It's costing a lot of money. It's having an impact. But also there, they haven't really done anything about it at all. It's not like they put a halt to it or put a stop or temporary stop. And there are some states in the U.S., like in New York, where they did pull the brake and said like, okay, you know, we can't do stuff like reviving gas plants for cryptocurrency mining. Those are the exceptions. But other than that, not much has happened. Yeah? Unlike, for example, China, where actually cryptocurrencies and cryptocurrency mining were completely banned in 2021. So yeah, that doesn't bode well for what we're going to do with artificial intelligence, because in the case of cryptocurrency mining, well, you can state that what those miners are doing is actually objectively not adding a whole lot of value to society, simply because those mining machines that they're using, they're doing a whole lot of computations, over 600 yeah. trillion a second, every second of the day, nonstop. And that's like 600 with 18 zeros.
Can I just interrupt you for a second, yeah. Alex, ask you, because we know there are a lot of people mining cryptocurrency who do it sort of as, you know, kind of like going back to day trading. You know, they do it, they're individuals, they do it at their home. I have a couple of close friends who I went to university with who do it, and they are constantly bragging about all this money they're making, but they never talk about the energy usage. And it makes me wonder, I mean, Energy is relatively cheap in the US, much more so than in Europe. And a lot of that is because we're still mining coal and things like that to make it, readily available, cheaper. But, what is the average person paying to mine cryptocurrency? And then how does this roll right into their use of AI?
Yeah, well, the thing is, like, the average person, most of them won't be able to mine cryptocurrencies anymore because you kind of requires very specialized equipment to be able to participate in something like Bitcoin mining. Like in the past, you could participate with a simple graphics card or, well, a little bit more advanced graphics card. But nowadays, hey, you need highly specialized equipment. In Bitcoin's case, what we call application-specific integrated circuits, a very technical term, but it's like a device that is purely made for cryptocurrency mining and can't do anything else. So, and it costs a lot to get the machine like this, and it costs even more to run it. So, and then of course, the cost of running it will depend on where you're based exactly. But the average household pays a lot more than those really large mining facilities loaded up with thousands of machines, where they tend to get very low wholesale rates, sometimes less than 5 cents per kilowatt hour. Like an average household can only dream of such rates. So
Alex, speaking of the average household, so I'm at home and if I were to use AI to create a paper or something, who's paying for that energy usage? Is that going to show up? Let's say I use ChatGPT for an hour. Is that energy usage going to show up on my bill, or is that energy usage going to show up at the warehouse of data banks or
yeah.
whatever is there mining the ChatGPT? I don't even know what they call it.
The data center.
The data center. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the energy consumption is mostly happening on the back end. So there is a little bit of front end energy consumption going on, of course. Hey, if you're using, well, depending on what device you're using, you have your desktop open, you're opening the ChatGPT website, and you're entering your prompt. Of course, having your machine running is also part of the energy consumption, but actually, the majority of it will be taking place in the back end and the surface of OpenAI in this case, who are paying the bill for all the electricity that's being consumed. And I guess ultimately they are trying to put that bill back in the users by making subscriptions and stuff like that. But I think right now they're actually mostly still burning investor money. So whoever is willing to put money into that. I mean, in the end, I guess the users would typically end up paying the bill regardless. But yeah, the majority of the energy consumption is not on your own computer. It's in the back end of the servers of OpenAI. Even say on an interaction level, interacting with ChatGPT is not as bad as you would think. I mean, you have, at least based on all the headlines you're seeing out there, a single interaction with ChatGPT will set you back like 3 watt hours of electricity, and that's a very low amount. That's like a low lumen LED light which you have running for 1 hour. But then again, it's 10 times more than a standard Google search. And you start realizing how energy intensive this is if you start thinking about the scale at which this is happening, because, this is not just one interaction that's taking place somewhere in the world, one time a day. No, this is happening. Well, in the case of Google, you're talking about 9 billion interactions a day. And if Google actually becomes like a ChatGPT, you're talking about the power consumption of a country like Ireland just to keep all of it running, and that's when it starts to scale up massively.
Well, Alex, in your paper, which was written last year in 2023, you'd say if Google decides to integrate AI into every search, it would lead to a surge in electrical usage. Well, they have. And so, I mean, it seems like it's only been recently that when you do a Google search, you get the AI answer at the top of every search. And I don't know if you guys get this in the Europe where you are, but we certainly get it here. And so that has to be an automatic increase in energy usage.
Yeah, so, well, one funny thing is that Google, they publish their environmental report like every summer, but they publish it over the prior year. And prior year, they didn't roll out AI overviews yet. They actually started doing that somewhere in this year. Forgot where it was exactly, like March or April somewhere. in any case, their environmental report this year, which was actually terrible, where they reported the 50% increase in carbon emissions compared to 2020, specifically pointing to AI as the cause of that, is saying, okay, our energy consumption is increasing, but also it's not just increasing energy consumption, the carbon emission is also going up because they are building out data center infrastructure. And of course, that construction is also responsible for a lot of carbon emissions as well. But they don't want to specify, they don't want to specify exactly what part AI is responsible for. So they say, okay, AI is causing all of this, but then subsequently they refuse to really specify at the AI level what's really happening. And then the thing is also, okay, we've only seen things up to 2023 at this point, and we have to wait until like next year to actually see the impact of the launch of AI overviews. So, but given how things are already before this was rolled out, I wouldn't expect things to look very good next year.
Yeah, I mean, the way I think Katie said in the intro that even Elon Musk said by 2025, he's not sure about the electricity that will be needed if there will be enough. And 2025 is just a month away. So, what are, for someone like you who has spent a lot of time researching this topic, what do you think the solution is? Are there solutions? Are there ways that AI can become more efficient in its energy consumption?
Well, it's really difficult because the thing is, as long as you are dealing with this technology where you have this bigger is better dynamic, it's kind of fundamentally incompatible with environmental sustainability, where less is always better. It's just not it's moving in opposite directions. So as long as that continues to be the case, I don't see this getting any better at all. The only good news is that now that AI is being used more and more, the internet is becoming more and more polluted with AI output, which means that actually making your newer models even bigger isn't guaranteed to make them better, because it can include a lot of, well, that AI output that I just mentioned, and that is actually useless for training new models. So in that sense, maybe the bigger is better dynamic will start to break soon. If that's the case, then ultimately, these models might even get smaller and start to have less of an impact, because over time, the technology is also improving. The hardware is improving over time, getting more efficient. So if we stop making these models bigger, they would ultimately take less energy to run. Except what's happening now is that our efficiency gains have at least historically been used to make the models bigger and bigger, and kind of that kind of completely negated our efficiency gain so far. Actually, the opposite has happened. We now use more energy on AI than ever before.
Yeah, so what does it mean for electrification? What as we head towards more electrification and more ability to provide more sustainable, more alternative sources of energy, what does it mean for that? Because that's a whole world that still hasn't, gotten to the point where it's clean, where it's actually good for our environment. There's a human toll. What does it mean for that?
Well, the thing is that if we, as long as we are boosting our energy demand, what's going to happen is that we're going to be using more fossil fuels one way or another. Like these tech companies, they love to buy up renewable energy sources because they want to make their environmental reports look great. But the thing is, the reality on our energy grid is that, well, first of all, our renewable energy supply is limited. Secondly, we're already prioritizing that renewable energy supply because we're in the middle of an energy transition. So whenever we have renewable energy available, we will prefer to use that over fossil fuels. If we have increasing energy demand, that increasing energy demand is going to be in some way fueled by our backup energy source, which is fossil fuels. And if we are putting our renewables in data centers, AI, then it just means that something somewhere else is going to be running on increasing amounts of fossil fuels, which makes us worse off from a climate perspective, regardless, no matter how good these environmental reports of the big tech companies are looking.
Alex, one of the things that AI and these AI companies like to tout is AI can solve all these problems. Do you think AI could actually come up with its own ways of creating its own electricity?
Well, it's certainly the easy way out. Huh? I mean, that's what actually Google did in their environmental report as well. Huh? They said, okay, our numbers are absolutely terrible, 50% increase since 2020. But you know what? AI is going to fix this. We have a target of net zero in 2030, and we fully believe that AI is going to help us get there, even though we're currently missing our target by a lot. Large amount, increasingly large amount. I personally don't like wishful thinking like that a lot. I mean, it's certainly the easy excuse. This problem will solve itself. I would like to add that in the past we have seen a lot of technological change. We've been seeing this since the Industrial Revolution. And the interesting thing is that even though we have had tremendous efficiency gains over the past 160 years, we now have more jobs than ever before. We didn't manage to make people obsolete despite developments like the internet. And I think this kind of this effect, what I'm trying to get to, is actually called Jevons paradox. It's where if you're making goods and services more efficient, you also boost demand for certain goods or services, where you end up using more in total than what you started out with. And this is very much a guiding principle. And we also see this happening with AI applications as well. So there is no real reason to assume that this will simply stop applying and that the problem will solve itself in the next few years, because the past 160 years kind of point the other way.
Well, and it's not just electricity that these large language models use. It's other resources like water and materials to create the servers and the chips. So how do we, let's just talk about water. Water is a global problem. How does AI's use of water compare to what normal, let's say, countries use?
Well, it's hard to say. I haven't done the numbers on that yet. I did do something recently for cryptocurrency mining, which, ironically, AI might soon be responsible for a similar amount of energy consumption. So maybe it will also be responsible for a similar amount of water consumption. In the case of cryptocurrency mining, you're talking about the water consumption that is equivalent to the water use of a country like Switzerland every year, which is due to two things. One is direct water use, because those machines, whether it's cryptocurrency mining machines or AI servers, they need cooling. And there's going to be water involved to do that. But actually, the bigger source of water consumption is actually one that most people forget about. It's the water that's being consumed for generating the electricity that's being consumed by these machines. If you have a fossil fuel-based power plant, those also have cooling systems, and they will use maybe 2 or 3 liters of water to generate 1 kilowatt hour of electricity that you also have to account for. Altogether, these numbers can also add up very quickly. I think someone already tried to quantify that a single session with ChatGPT could cost as much water, or something like half a bottle of water, half a liter of water, so something in that direction. That's also something to keep in mind when you're using these applications.
As a way to wrap this up, Alex, and it sounds very doom and gloom, I have to say, you living in, I believe you're from Amsterdam, is that right? You live in Holland?
Yes.
In the Netherlands. And so, you know, you're part of a continent where actual inroads are made all the time to save energy and to reduce the use of fossil fuels. What do you see, especially with nuclear, for example? Do you see something like that as a solution, or what do you see as a solution, if anything?
Well, nuclear, definitely not a solution. And the thing is that, first of all, there's very little nuclear power that you can use for this type of applications, because you really have to start looking for mothball nuclear reactors to revive for this kind of purposes. And there are not a lot of old mothball nuclear reactors that qualify to be revived, because the thing is, once you shut down a nuclear reactor, they start to decay. And at a certain point, it becomes really tricky to get them back operational. Only a few of these might qualify to be brought back to life. It's not going to be enough to fuel all our AI energy needs, and building out new nuclear energy infrastructure, that might sound like a good idea, but keep in mind that these are very long-term projects. This can take more than a decade to be completed in some cases. If you're dealing with an AI hype today, you don't want to wait 10 years until you get your power. So I don't see that as a very viable solution either, along with a lot of financial risks that get included when you have such a long time frame you're dealing with. I think the first thing to do would really to get more data, because right now we see that companies like Google are just actively refusing to provide very specific AI-related data. Yeah, as long as we are not getting the data as the end users, how are we going to make, for example, more responsible decisions? Like, the thing in the digital world is that whenever you're using a certain application, the environmental implications can be as different as choosing between a candy bar and an apple. Except the thing is that in a digital world, this is never tangible. You never get to see this, and you can never imagine really what's going on to make your application happen. So we are really dependent on those tech companies to provide us with the information we need to be able to properly assess these different choices that we have. And as long as we're not getting it, good luck making those choices. So I think this is really the starting point. We should be getting a lot more data to be able to make this type of choices, and maybe also start to consider things like not using AI. Maybe a more simple application is already sufficient.
like our own brain, you mean? and Alex, we all know that these big tech companies can't be trusted to govern themselves and willfully give us the data that we need. This is a very important topic, and we will link your paper on our website for people that want to go in and read it. And our guest today has been Alex DeVries. He is the author of the paper, The Growing Energy Footprint of Artificial Intelligence. Alex, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Cool Science Radio.
Very welcome.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Today's technology has overtaken religion as the chief influence on 21st century life and community. So how can we be critical thinkers with respect to this new faith and even reassert our common humanity beyond the seductive sheen of tech? And is tech agnosticism, well, not worshiping it, possible even as a way of life? Without suggesting we return to a mythical pre-tech past, Greg Epstein, humanist chaplain at Harvard and MIT, shows why we must maintain a free-thinking, critical perspective toward innovation until it proves itself worthy of our faith in his new book, Tech Agnostic: How Technology Became the World's Most Powerful Religion and Why It Desperately Needs a Reformation. Greg, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Katie. Great to be with you and Lynn.
You know, in reading your book, you start out with how we do look like we're all worshiping something. We all walk around with this device in our hands, constantly monitoring it, constantly almost bowing to it. What was it that really triggered you to write this book and talk about this topic?
Yeah, we really do, don't we? I mean, and it's not an accident. It turns out after 6 years of research on this book, what triggered me was I had been building a kind of alternative congregation at Harvard for about a decade. I wanted to create a kind of secular community for my, you know, non-religious community members that would bring the world closer together. But after about a decade of that, I got invited to join MIT, and I realized, bringing the world closer together, that's what Mark Zuckerberg sees himself as doing. In fact, that was a language from Facebook's rewritten mission statement in 2017. And I realized, I've been studying religious congregations and communities my whole life, but this new Silicon Valley social media phenomenon just rewrote the book on all of that. And then I wondered, wait, are there other ways in which Silicon Valley tech is looking like what I studied as religion? And I started making a list of comparisons between tech and religion, and I have never stopped. There are so many ways in which the two are similar now.
Let's talk about Zuckerberg and the social media platforms that create these algorithms that determine what we see, which seems like very much a controlling religious perspective as well. We're only going to let our followers have certain perspectives. Mm. And, you know, we have this belief that, well, we'll see whatever we want to on social media. Is this an intentional correlation, or do you think this evolution into some sort of dominant religion was accidental or intentional?
Well, I mean, with Zuckerberg and Facebook and sites like that, for example, I mean, I'm not anti-technology. This is not an anti-technology book. I wouldn't even know what such a book would look like or how to write one. But what I think we are, many of us are really rightfully critical of, and what the book mainly tries to explore, is the way in which Facebook made us not the customer or the user, it made us the product, right? When we're using Facebook, we all have a sense of this now. It's free because they don't want our money. They want our data. They want our eyeballs so that they can sell them to advertising companies and make $1 trillion. And that's about what Facebook has made in advertising sales, you know, over the course of its history thus far. Google has also, you know, made over $1 trillion in similar ways. And so we are the product. And if you look at so many of the technologies that are dominant today and that are rising to become even more dominant, AI and what have you, we are all humans. We are becoming the product. We're being sold for profit. And that's the kind of new Silicon Valley ideology that we don't really talk about nearly enough. That's at the heart of what I'm calling this new dominant religion.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Greg Epstein. He is the humanist chaplain at MIT and Harvard, and he's written a new book called Tech Agnostic. Greg, what is a humanist in your definition?
Yeah, so my first book is all about that. It's called Good Without God, What a Billion Non-Religious People Do Believe. And the idea is that there is a very quickly growing, and it has been for quite some time now, for a couple decades now, a quickly growing non-religious population in the United States and beyond. People who would otherwise identify as atheist, agnostic, secular, non-religious, unaffiliated, just none of the above. And these people are often deeply ethically minded people. They really want to live meaningful, purposeful lives. They want to live in a healthy community. They want to help build a better world for everyone. And humanism is a name that has been given to that approach to life for over a century. And it represents a tradition, a way of approaching being human that goes back millennia. What I wanted to do in writing that first book was sort of introduce people to that idea, because it was one of the sort of least well understood ideas of the 20th century. And then in Tech Agnostic, I'm arguing that you can take a kind of humanist approach to tech, that we can create technology that is focused on making human lives better, on building a better human society, not building a god, as so many of the AI leaders and the AI discourses tell us is what we're trying to do.
Oh, I love that. Well, Greg, if we look, you know, when I first looked at your book, the cover, I thought, well, you know, maybe this is about turning away from social media. And it's about so much more than that. Mm-hmm. With social media, we have a choice to engage or not engage. Mm-hmm. But really, with technology in general, we don't have that choice to engage or not engage. It's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. And you know, whether or not it's controlling us is another question. Just last night, someone sent me an article about a mother who lost her son after he took his life, after being associated with some chatbots at character.ai. And it's a heartbreaking story. And it also plays into this bigger question about how we will regulate AI. And, you know, what's going on in this sinister world that someone like you is trying to bring to light? Can you talk a little bit about AI and what you're seeing there?
Yeah. So first, I want to address just the basic structure of the book so people have a sense of what I'm arguing. And then I'd love to talk about that site character AI that you just mentioned. I think it's really important part of this conversation. So, you know, my book is a sort of extended comparison. There are a lot of fun parts in it, I hope, but it's a serious comparison. Each chapter takes a different aspect of the structure of religion and compares it to a different aspect of contemporary tech. And, you know, one of the things that I say in it is this is not, tech is not like a religion today in the sense of a cafeteria religion is what they call it, where you can, you know, you can wear a Kabbalah or Jewish mystical bracelet and you can have a Catholic rosary and you do a little Buddhist meditation. This is like the ancient religions where you were born in a certain realm and there was a certain god above you and there was a certain temple that you had to go to. And if you didn't like that or you didn't want to do that, nobody cared. You were forced to do it. And that is how we live our lives with regard to tech today. Imagine telling a child in the year 2024, the year of our AI Lord, I suppose, that they're not supposed to use any technology. If you send that child to any kind of school in this country and you tell them don't use any tech, they'll come back home and they'll say to you, Mom, Dad, you've gone off the deep end. This is the center of everybody's life. How could I not use it? Now, fast forward to Character AI, an AI site that has these, I guess, charming little chatbots. Many of them are impersonating God or gods. Others are impersonating pop culture characters, anything you can imagine. The site was created by a guy. His name was Noam Shazier. He left Google in a huff a few years ago because Google wouldn't let him release one of his favorite chatbots that he designed. So he created this site. He marketed it to teens and kids. And then Google recently bought him back. They paid his site, Character AI, $2.7 billion for the privilege of hiring him back. Now, that site is implicated in the death of the teenager I think you were mentioning, Sewell Setzer III, because when Sewell, a possibly Asperger's autistic, but really wonderful young man by all accounts, beloved, good family, he got addicted to using that chatbot instead of relating to other humans, using it for affirmation, for love, and it led him down a very dark path of self-harm. And by the way, there are other reports more recently of other ways in which that same site, Character AI, is coaching kids to harm themselves, to cut themselves and such, and it's not flagging the authorities in the way that it promised to. Surprise, surprise, we are the product here.
Well, Greg, how has your stance on this and your perspective evolved since the election? Because we did see techs, we were all, I don't want to say victims of, but we are all suffering the consequences, if you will, of tech's influence on what happened in the election. And how do you see your perspective on this post-election?
Yeah, I mean, it's no secret that I had a rooting interest in this election. And, you know, let's just say, you know, it didn't turn out exactly how I would have drawn it up. But, you know, I think that regardless of where you are, you know, on our political spectrum, you can admit that AI and other forms of technology are mucking around with our democracy. If we're being told falsehoods, then it's harder to make up our minds about what is reality and what we should vote for. And, you know, you don't need to apply that to Trump and Harris. You know, it can just be, you look at Google's AI system, right? Google used to be the most, you know, synonymous with you ask a question and you get an accurate answer. But now, because Google has turned its search engine over to its AI chatbot, Gemini, a chatbot, which, by the way, was created in order to help resurrect, quote unquote, its, you know, one of its main creator, Ray Kurzweil's dead father. But hey, that's not religiously creepy at all or anything, right? Anyway, Gemini, you know, will give you answers now. Like if you ask it, well, how do I get the cheese to stop sliding off my pizza? It will tell you sometimes, never know when, glue it on. Right? That's the kind of quality information that real people are getting from Google now. And so in an environment like that, it becomes much, much easier to just spread lies. And if we can't trust the information that we're getting, then it's a lot harder to vote for good candidates that will create a better society. It seems pretty simple to me.
Well, like you said, tech is everywhere. We can't get in our cars without it. We certainly can't communicate without it. But how do we stand up against this religion, if you will, how can we be skeptical and critical and not be labeled a heretic, because with so many people, you bring this up and they, you know, they, well, you're just a Luddite, or you don't understand it, or, you know, it's time to join the 21st or 21st century. But that's not a good argument on their end. So how do we, as those of us that are skeptical of this, approach this challenge?
So first of all, I mean, I love the car thing, because, you know, what I'm arguing is that religion and traditional gods, ethics, et cetera, had, you know, were for most of human history the kind of centerpiece of our lives. But if you want to get a sense of how central tech is to our lives now, just imagine you're getting in your new car and, you know, you can't get your phone to connect to it, right? I mean, it's almost, you know, if you have a faulty connection between your phone and your car now, it's like having a faulty steering wheel. I mean, you know, it's just so frustrating, right? So it's the center of our lives in all, in 100, 1,000, 1,000,000 little ways. But you ask, you know, how can you criticize this without being called a heretic or an apostate or whatever? Well, I think that should be a term of pride. Now, I mean, if this has become our new faith, our new religion, our new way of living is to center our lives around this tech rather than having it be centered around our needs and what improves our relationships, our humanity, our society, then, you know, what I lay out in the book, about one third to a half of this book, Tech Agnostic, is it's about the positive alternative, because people all around the world are creating positive alternatives to overwhelming dogma, to manipulative faith. You know, there, it's not anti-religious, because lots and lots of people want a reformation in their religion. And that's what I like. I like reformed religions, people who know how to criticize extremism and fundamentalism. They may be deep believers, but when it comes to extremist, you know, extremist manipulative religion, whether in traditional faith or in tech, they're heretics, they're apostates, they're not going to stand for it. They want the truth, they want justice. And that's what, you know, I tell the stories of people in the tech world who are doing just that, who are fighting for a more equitable tech world. They're fighting for tech to be centered on human needs and not having us be the product. And a lot of the times, the stories that I was able to tell, people kind of let me into their lives. People fighting for that go through really, really difficult, painful experiences, but they keep pushing through and they make tremendous change. That was one of the most fun aspects, meaningful aspects of reporting and writing this book.
I love that. Could you go into that a little deeper? Because we know that one of the things we do with our young people is we say, you know, study computer science, you'll always have a job. And I did that with my kids. They're both software developers, and yet they struggle. They struggle working in that world. And so, you know, from a personal perspective, I want to ask you how people, how young people that who go into these fields can make dynamic evolution of technology.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really powerful question, because your kids are not alone in having been ushered into this new field, right? There's so many messages out there telling people to work on AI and computers. And so, for example, there's a movement called effective altruism, which is maybe not quite as big as some of the other traditional religions in terms of numbers of followers around the world, but it's a new sort of philosophy. I lay out ways in my book in which it really is like a new religion that argues that the number one most important thing that a young person could possibly do with their lives is to work on runaway or unaligned or essentially evil AI, because they're saying that this is the biggest problem that humanity faces, bigger than climate change, bigger than racism, bigger than injustice, bigger than nuclear weapons, whatever. And so what they're saying essentially is you have to do AI their way. Their way, meaning not just this, you know, group of people who are, you know, effective altruists, but the billionaires that are backing them, the tech companies that are sort of where they're most dominant. They're kind of laying out a scenario, as I go through in the book, where you can do AI their way and we'll all get to heaven, where one day, millions of years from now, there'll be trillions of digital beings uploaded into the clouds and everything will be a wonderful, perfect utopia. And I mean, honestly, it reads, the texts about this, which are backed by billionaires, read like absolute epistles from the Bible. And then if you don't do AI that way, we'll all get to hell. There's a 10% chance, they say, that all of humanity will be completely wiped out within this century by the AI that we're currently investing trillions of dollars in. And so, you know, it's scary. And it's scary, I think, Lynn, because it's emotionally unaware. It's emotionally deprived. You know, people who are building some of these technologies will tell you, you know, that it's not important to have better human communities, better human relationships. We need to focus on the tech because they themselves are not being taught how to have healthy, loving, caring, vulnerable human relationships. That's not emphasized in the tech world. And in fact, the tech world is kind of like a giant vacuum cleaner to suck up anybody and everybody who's been taught to have a deficit in that area, and instead to over-focus on, you know, important things like science and technology and logic, you know, at the expense, though, of the ability to connect. And so, you know, I'm not worried about kids, you know, being taught to go into tech. That's fine. It's one of many career fields that you can make a good living in. You can contribute something to society in. But we've got to teach our kids how to love being human and love other humans and be loved by other humans much better than Silicon Valley, this mythological religious place, is teaching them. Because if we don't, then we're going to have this incredibly powerful, incredibly wealthy tech world, and we're going to have the rest of us humans, and there's going to be a deep, deep divide between the two.
So interesting. You know, further drawing on this metaphor of religion and technology, if you think about religion, and this has just been coming to light for me since you've been talking, you know, religion is never reformed from the top down. It has to be from the bottom up, from the followers suddenly saying, this is not working, this is not working. And yet with technology, we're sort of expecting for it to be reformed from the top down with more regulation of things like character.ai and AI in general. But will that work? You know, just like it would never have worked on religion, I suppose. In religion, you know, maybe an offshoot, a different religion starts, you know, a leader takes their followers off and starts another branch of a religion. I don't know. It's just an interesting.
Yeah. I mean, the quote that comes to mind in response to that is, I believe it was Frederick Douglass who said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. And the issue there is Frederick Douglass was an enslaved person in a world where, you know, religion was very much a part of enslaving people. On the other hand, however, there were a lot of Christians, social justice, social gospel, they were called, oriented Christians, who fought very, very hard against slavery and against, you know, using people as products. And that's a great metaphor, a great parallel for what I'm arguing for in the tech world today. There are powerful tech barons, demigods perhaps, who, you know, will never concede without a demand that, you know, they've built something that really enables, you know, it enables there to be a utopia for them. Right. That, you know, these billionaires really are living in a utopia, whether it's on their own actual island or, you know, touring their own wonderful bunker that they're going to have when the rest of us have to go under somewhere else. And, you know, the tech world, the tech religion, as I'm calling it, has enabled a lot of the inequity and injustice that we have today. But like with the parallel of the social gospel Christians in older times and still today, many of them very much today, there are grassroots people in tech who are fighting to make sure that their innovation, that their knowledge, that their talent is used for the good and for all humans. And I honor that, you know, and so I walk people through at the sort of closing chapters of the book, what I'm calling tech humanists and spiritual practitioners who are fighting for a better alternative. They're creating technologies that, you know, that are very different from the traditional Silicon Valley business model. And there's even one chapter at the end of the book is about what I'm calling a tech ethics or tech responsibility congregation, an organization centered in New York City, but with branches all over the world that is pulling together tens of thousands of people who love tech, who want to work in tech, but who want to do so responsibly and ethically and want to support for doing that and want to support one another. They're mentoring each other's in careers. They're lobbying together. They're supporting one another. It's really interesting to see. And so that's the sort of thing that, you know, I want people to know is in this book in great detail and a lot of fun stories.
Well, Greg, thank you for writing this book because I know it gives Lynn and myself hope that there is something we can do besides just succumbing to the tech and AI overlords that all of us envision. Well, our guest today has been Greg Epstein. He is the humanist chaplain at Harvard and MIT, and he's talking about his new, very important book, Tech Agnostic, How Technology Became the World's Most Powerful Religion and Why It Desperately Needs a Reformation. Greg, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab or on the KPCW app or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio. And if you liked today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.